The number of new international college students in the U.S. has decreased for the second straight year. Some worry that that's because of our political climate. But Illinois State's Yimin Wong says that's just part of the picture.
Of course, we heard a lot about the political reasons within the United States, but there are also other reasons. For example, the economic growth pattern in many countries, political changes in many parts of the world, and also how different national governments have been building their own capacity within higher education.
Plus, open enrollment for the healthcare marketplace goes until December 15th. We've got some experts to help you understand that and what's going on with the Affordable Care Act. And a man named Clark Robinson Griggs played a huge part in making sure the U of I would call Champaign-Urbana home. So why has he been largely written out of our history? That's all coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up on today's show, the story of how the University of Illinois' flagship school wound up here in Champaign-Urbana and why that story is relatively unknown. Plus, if you're buying health insurance through the online marketplace, open enrollment ends December 15th. We'll cover what you need to know. But first, for years, hundreds of thousands of international college students have flocked to campuses across the U.S. in hopes of an American-style education. And today, the U.S. is still the most popular destination. Last year, the total number of enrolled international students was more than 1 million. But over the last 2 years, the number of new international students has started to fall off. Last year, the enrollment of those new international students fell by more than 6%. So what's behind all of this? Yiming Wong works at the International Recruitment and Enrollment as the executive director of the Into Illinois State University Center. She joins us from Normal. And Scott Jasek is the editor of Inside Higher Ed, and he's with us from Washington. To you both, welcome to the 21st, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Yiming,
Yiming,
I'd like to start with you. The U.S. has always been a destination for international students. So historically speaking, why has it been so appealing?
Well, you know, U.S. has been the number one destination for international students. It still is the number one destination for international students to study abroad. U.S. does provide excellent, outstanding, world-class higher education system and institutions programs to students worldwide. You know, this is our proud tradition. And also, for countries worldwide, using China as example, where I'm from, so starting from 1920s, Chinese intellectuals started the journey of embracing Western culture, building the country through learning from the Western world. So, you know, that tradition persists, and that made American higher education systems really popular. And also now with globalization, you know, the desire of learning from each other, learning from educational system and the world-class universities, just a common pursuit of many international students who came here to study, myself included.
And Scott, could you give us a sense of where the most international students are coming from?
Sure. The top senders are China, India, and Korea, and it's been that way for a long time. But it's also important to remember that that can change quickly. Before the Shah fell, Iran was a top supplier of international students to the United States, and then that went to zero. So these trends can change rapidly.
Can you expand a little bit on how it has changed over the years? Are we seeing students from different countries now than we would say 10 to 20 years ago based on your example?
Sure. So starting in the post-World War II era, we saw top graduate students come to the United States. Historically, they would have been more likely to go to Britain, to Oxford and Cambridge. They started coming to the United States. In the last 15 to 20 years, we've seen dramatic growth among the undergraduate population, which is different. And we've seen that for a number of reasons. One is that there is a larger middle class in China and India and elsewhere that can afford to pay for college here, whereas many of the graduate students historically were subsidized, received fellowships just as U.S. graduate students do. The undergraduates were generally seen as paying their own way. So those numbers went up in the last 10 to 15 years, but now may be threatened a bit.
And speaking of those numbers being threatened, Yemen, despite the popularity of coming to the U.S., as we mentioned before, the numbers are dropping 6% compared with the years before. So why is that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are just a lot of reasons to that. On top of it, people think about the political atmosphere in the United States, but also because of the mode of economic development in many countries, right? During the past 10 years, the number of international students from China have been increasing until 1 to 2 years ago, but that also coincides with the very rapid economic growth in China. And also, you know, many countries have been very intentional in building the capacity of their own higher education systems. So with that trend, there is always a timeline of when the national government sends students to study abroad and then come back to build the capacity that impacted on the trend of sponsorship from different governments, different national governments. So all those factors added together, I think that impacted on the trend of international students growth or decrease in the United States. Having said that, at ISU, we actually have seen a very rapid growth of the number of international students this year. So,
yeah, I actually believe Illinois numbers are up by 2% overall. And although the U of I in particular, that number did go down. But as you're saying, ISU has gone up. So, Scott, how does that break down across the state as well as the region?
Well, again, if you look generally, what you need to pay attention to are the numbers for new students. The reason those are the important numbers is that most college programs here are longer than a year. So when you have 2 years in a row that the number of new students are down nationally, you're going to see an impact, especially if that continues. Generally, we are hearing that larger universities, research universities, are faring better. Smaller institutions, institutions that don't have as much of a tradition in recruiting from outside the United States, are faring worse. So it's not surprising that the U of Illinois and Illinois State still have plenty of international students, but they need to take this very seriously. If you go back to the period I was talking about when the U.S. had a monopoly, sort of post-World War II, well, these days there are great universities in Canada, New Zealand, Australia that are going after these same students, don't have the same political environment, and in many cases those are less expensive to attend. So we have a real challenges, political and otherwise.
Well, and Yemin, you actually work with recruitment, so you talk a lot with these students and their parents. So when you are talking with families, what do they bring up as far as concerns, and has that changed over time?
Well, safety has always been a concern, or the number one priority when they choose an institution or especially a destination, right? When you have a kid going abroad and thousands of miles away, that's certainly a very, very important concern. And also funding, scholarships, visa approval rate is becoming more and more of a concern, as well as the employment prospect, right? Not only for after students graduate, whether they want to have a short-term internship in the United States or just work for a couple of years here in the United States, how the political atmosphere impact on all those factors have been the concerns or the questions that parents and students ask.
We're talking about international student enrollment at universities in the U.S. as well as here in Illinois on the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield. My guests are Yiming Wong, speaking to us from Normal, and Scott Jasek from Washington, D.C. And now joining us from our studios here in Urbana, Hejantina Yeo, a doctoral candidate at the University of Illinois Department of Higher Education. And in fact, her research focuses on international students and their racial experiences at U.S. institutions. So I want to welcome you, Hejin, and ask you, as we have been looking at these numbers, which tell the story that the U.S. is still a popular higher ed destination, right, for students around the world, but not as much this year as it was maybe in years past. So I'd like to ask you about what life is like for students when they get here. What are some common challenges that international students face once they arrive at school?
Okay. Thank you for having me. Well, when we think about the international students' challenges, we easily think like English proficiency or cultural differences, it is very easily say so, but it's and then also people think once international students improve their English and then learn U.S. cultures, their difficulties or poor treatment will go away, which is not true. Mostly international student challenges is more beyond English proficiency. So even though as myself as an international student, I think my English proficiency is enough to communicate, learn and teach. Mm-hmm. But whenever I face some kind of problems, so for example, when I have some phone issues, when I go to the phone company agencies, I don't know where I should start describing my problems. When I describe my problems, it's based on my Korean culture,
okay,
which I'm originally from. So, well, it's not just only English. It's all the how the society operate system is different. So international students different. When they face any other issues, they automatically in their mind, they think in their the home country's way, but which is totally different. But they face the people are not really tolerant to where the different ways to approach the problem solving or thinking skills. I want to really emphasize those kind of different challenges rather than just focusing on English proficiency.
Are you seeing here at the U of I or any other universities that they are trying to help students acclimate in these more social ways as opposed to just logistical ways?
Well, honestly, unfortunately, no. Well, the U.S. college and universities are providing many English proficiency program, English intensive programs, which is, I think, that's a very basic levels of solutions. But in social ways, I don't know. I would say no. But U of I is doing a good job on that, and the LAS Liberal Arts and Science College. They are providing freshman seminar course for international students. In that course, we are trying to touch on some of the social issues for international students so that they can understand some what kinds of different social issues the U.S. has. Yeah.
Well, and Yimin earlier talked about families' concerns about safety and mm-hmm. money and job prospects. Do those concerns carry over to the students' day-to-day lives when they actually get here to the U.S.?
Yes. At first, when they were in their home countries, when they think of the safety, it's just mostly about gun. But once they arrived here, when they leave here, they faced some of the racial discriminations and gender discriminations or religion discrimination. In regarding that way, they started feeling different levels of safety concerns, which they don't have, international students don't have much resources, and they don't know how to, even in terms of the racial discrimination, most international students are not really realize that that's a racial discrimination. At first, they just attributed it themselves, like, oh, it's because of my English. It's maybe because I don't know U.S. culture. So that's very, I think, harmful for in terms of international students' self-esteem and confidence level. It turns out now later it become a very traumatized experience. Yeah.
Well, and Yimin, could you speak to how the internet plays in all of this?
Well, internet certainly brings the world together, brings the people together, and, you know, make people feel closer across oceans and in different countries. For example, at ISU here, we provide a lot of social support for our students. Our goal is to have international students fully engaged on campus and in the community. We also see them as resources to bring the whole world to us. I have a good example. Most recently, I learned how our students spend their evenings and the weekend going to the concert or playing at a concert here on ISU campus from the WeChat, which is a popular social media platform of their parents and their education counselors in China. So basically, they posted how they spend their weekends and their lives here. And then it was forwarded by the education counselors and their parents. And then I got to know about their lives from all those social media platforms. So that shows the power of internet and how people, you know, it just brings people together, brings people closer. And yesterday we had a fusion lunch of Chinese food and pie together. And we also work with students to write letters to their families and so let them know that they're safe, they're engaged here. And all those have been publicized just overnight on different social media platforms. all over the world. So I do see that connectedness. I see internet does provide a very good opportunity for us to stay connected and provide that overall support for our students, both from our home institution and from and also from their home country.
And before we go, I want to ask about some recent news. And Scott, I think you can help with this. The University of Illinois recently did something that sounds pretty unusual for a public university, in my opinion. They actually paid $424,000 to insure themselves against a possible drop in Chinese student enrollment. So what's that all about?
So they are worried about a potential drop in Chinese enrollment, and they're believed to be the first university anywhere to do this. The reality is, if you look at the enrollments, particularly in the business and engineering colleges where they did this insurance policy, they are depending on international students for tuition revenue. There is a great educational reason for recruiting the best and brightest minds from around the world, and it not only helps them, but American students. But U.S. universities are very highly motivated by tuition revenue. It is not, and they're concerned that, look, our relations with China go up and down depending on which day of the week it is. A bitter trade war could lead to limits on visas. Already the Trump administration is upping vetting of Chinese students. Any real change could have a dramatic impact on Illinois' budget, with Illinois not having done anything to cause this. So it's serious money.
Well, I want to thank our guests, Yiming Wang, Scott Jasek, and Hejin Tina Yeo. All of you, thanks for being with us. Coming up on the 21st, if you're shopping for health insurance, we're going to be talking about this oftentimes confusing process. So more on the ACA to come. Have your questions ready and stay tuned. Thanks so much.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting a booth at the Urbana Holiday Market in the Square December 8th and December 15th, featuring regional and special interest titles for every book lover on your list. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Are you one of the millions making that dreaded decision this month? What health insurance should I sign up for? You're not alone, and the health care continues to take top priority in Washington. The Democrats made it their signature issue in the midterm elections last month, and now that they've won the majority in the House, Republicans' attempts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act are most likely on hold. In the meantime, open enrollment for the online marketplace is going on right now and has been since November 1st. Individuals can sign up through December 15th at healthcare.gov, excuse me. So what is the state of the ACA right now, and what do we need to know when we're shopping for health insurance? Lisa Schenker is a reporter covering the healthcare issue for Chicago Tribune. Barbara Otto is the CEO of the Chicago outreach organization Smart Policy Works. Both of you, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Lisa, I want to start with you. ACA has been a precarious place, or in a precarious place, and topic, actually, for such a long time. So what's the state of it as we know right now?
Well, it is still in effect. The law is still there. And open enrollment is happening right now through December 15th. People can go on to healthcare.gov and select plans for 2019.
And Barbara, are you surprised at all that this law is still standing, given that Republicans have been trying to repeal it for so very long?
Well, I think it's a testament to how valuable this access to healthcare is to the American people. It's no sort of secret that people need healthcare, and prior to the ACA were losing their homes. And making major life decisions based on losing their homes because they couldn't afford their health care if they had a catastrophic accident. So health care is really critical, and I'm not surprised that it's still standing, because once you give people a benefit that they want, need, and value, it's really difficult to take that away.
Well, and We should note that even though it's still standing, Lisa, you reported a few weeks ago that enrollment numbers in Illinois are down from last year. So are you still finding that that's the case just 2 weeks out from the deadline?
Yes. It looked like as of the fourth week, enrollment was still down compared to last year. After the first 4 weeks, about 74,000 plans had been selected in Illinois. That was down from about 95,000 plans the year before.
And I'd be curious on both sides, both Lisa and Barbara, do you get a sense on why this is dropping? Lisa, I'll go to you first and then Barbara.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of different theories out there. A big one is that in 2019, there's going to be no more penalty for not having insurance. That was a big part of the Affordable Care Act, and that's something that has since been done away with. So if you don't have insurance next year, you don't have to pay a fine. So that might be a reason people aren't buying plans. It's also possible people aren't buying plans because the federal government gave Illinois and other states a lot less money this year for navigators, who are people that help others enroll in plans.
Oh, okay.
So there are, and there's also other options out there now that are cheaper.
And Barbara?
Well, I would agree with Lisa that I think it's not that Obamacare is losing its appeal. It's that we don't have enough resources at the state level to advertise and provide consumers with assistance. I think people, after last year's political debate, a lot of people don't even think that Obamacare still exists. I find people that I talk to just at the grocery store or on the train who know what I do for a living ask me, oh, is that Obamacare still out there? You know, I think people, because it's been unfunded or underfunded and under-resourced, people don't realize that they can get help picking a plan and may not even realize it's still there for them.
And do you think that's also because they think that this particular healthcare system goes with the presidency, like the administration, and therefore Obama not being in office means it's gone? Or
I think it could be a little bit of that. I think it also could be just the media. What was not to blame the media, but what do we see the most in the headlines? We hear about threats to Obamacare. We hear about the fact that premiums are going up, when in fact in Illinois, the lowest cost silver plan premium decreased by 6%. Same thing with the gold plan. So I think people are hearing it costs more and it doesn't exist, or it doesn't exist for me. I think a lot of people now, when they think about Obamacare, they think about only the very poor getting access to something. So I think a lot of it has to do with the fact we have no navigators and we're not getting consistent information about the program.
And Lisa, Barbara just mentioned there about the premiums. So could you get into a little bit about how those have gone in Illinois, both recently and historically since the Affordable Care Act started?
Sure. For a long time, rates were going up, but rates are actually down this year. The lowest priced silver plans, which are very popular, the rates are down by 4% for 2019, 3% for the second lowest priced silver plans. Gold plans are going up slightly, but it's a very different story than in years past, and that's something we've reported on many times.
Well, and Lisa, how are the health insurers feeling? We know that they've been a little bit nervous in the past few years, especially when the future of the ACA was uncertain. How are they feeling in Illinois in particular, and how does that affect the premiums that you were just talking about?
I mean, this year we didn't lose any insurers in Illinois, which was different than in years past. In fact, we actually had another insurer join the state, although that insurer is offering plans outside of kind of the Chicago and Chicago metro areas. So it seems like insurers, at least in Illinois, aren't fleeing at the moment, and they lowered their rates. So that, you know, seems to signify that they're not doing horribly in the exchanges anymore.
Yeah, so we've been speaking with Lisa Schenker from Chicago Tribune and Barbara Otto with Smart Policy Works. I also want to bring in Dan Weissman. He's a longtime public radio journalist from Chicago, also the host of the podcast An Arm and a Leg, which talks about the cost of healthcare. So, Dan, welcome back to the show and welcome to the conversation.
Thanks, Liz.
So, Dan, as a freelancer, I assume you've had to pick a plan for yourself. So can you talk about what that was like? And did you find that it was hard to find a plan that was right for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in our family's condition, and we talked about this in the first episode of An Arm and a Leg, which came out just last month. You know, it was a big reason to be scared to become a freelancer. I'm really delighted that, you know, that there is an option to, like, that the ACA affords, that, like, you can buy insurance, like, no matter what. But, you know, our family had certain doctors that we're used to seeing, and in fact, like, we have our little basket of pre-existing conditions, so it's important that we can get insurance, but, like, the doctors we see, not on any of the plans. So we have been kind of steering our own ship. My wife has her own business, and this year, early in the year, she added an employee so that we could get considered for group coverage, which looks like what we're going to do. So that's our story. That, you know, we looked at the Obamacare exchanges and thought, like, glad they exist, but we also went looking for other alternatives.
Well, and Dan, I think you were mentioning a few of those things there, that the doctors that you had come to know and love were not maybe on all the plans. But as you started to look through the online marketplace, what were the things that you were looking for? Did you have a checklist, certain priorities that you wanted to hit, and were you able to hit those?
Well, yeah. I mean, the big thing is, you know, for our conditions, like, I have a congenital heart defect. It does not bother me. It just needs to be not a problem, but it needs to be monitored. And there's, like, one place in Chicago that, like, specializes in folks like me, and they're not on any of the exchanges. And I went back and I looked at, you know, well, gosh, what did that cost? What was the sticker price for that if I were on my own, if it wasn't covered by my insurance? And, you know, it's just one test and one doc visit, but they were each charged at, like, $6,000.
Wow.
I was like, well, I think we want a plan that covers those things, right? That covers that place. So that was the big, I mean, there were other providers, but that was one of the ones where we were like, yeah, we should get an alternative, because that's $12,000.
Well, and I think you hit on an important point there, like the idea of pre-existing conditions and still being able to get health care. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, a personal note about myself, I got denied health insurance, and it was a very scary time. I went without health insurance for a year and a half to almost 2 years because no one would cover me. And then the Affordable Care Act came around, and that changed things where people were able to get covered, even though they may have a quote, unquote, pre-existing condition. But to your point, they can still be very expensive, correct?
It totally depends, right? And you know, this is where how we decided to look. We could have gone the other way and been like, okay, let's see who is on this plan, and if we could see ourselves like living within those restrictions, right? I mean, it's a complicated bunch of things, and so this is, you know, for a lot of, and it's hard to evaluate, you know, what an individual plan is likely to cost you, because, you know, how likely are you to be dedicated, how committed are you, right? How ready are you to
right.
say, like, I'm only going to see doctors on this plan? And then there's just a lot of math to do to figure out, like, oh, crap, like, okay, there's the premium, there's a deductible, there's not a pocket limit, there's this, like, it gets to be a big piece of work for a lot of people pretty fast.
It does, and it can be very confusing. And Barbara, I'm interested, wondering if you're hearing Dan's story right now and you're like, oh, this is so common, or not?
Oh, it is so common. And Dan, you should have called me. Dan and I know each other. But, you know, what Dan is speaking to really underlines the importance of having help looking through all these plans. Dan is a fairly, on the scale, has a lot of high healthcare literacy. He understands that he needs to look at whether his doctor is in network. He needs to understand what an out-of-pocket payment might be, or what a co-payment might be, or what a deductible is. Most people are not consumers of healthcare, and they don't have healthcare literacy. And that's why funding, either for navigators or even funding, having brokers available to people is really critical. And we just don't have that this year. And I think that might be why we're seeing more and more people not signing up for coverage.
And Barbara, can you give us a better sense of how these navigators work? So it's one thing to have funding for them, but what is their day-to-day like? How are they actually educating the public on the open online marketplace?
So how it basically works is they ask individuals to come to them once they schedule an appointment. And if you are looking for help, you can go to healthcare.gov and click on Find Local Help, and you'll get a list of organizations that can do that for you. You can get there through getcoveredillinois.gov. They also can help you find local help, or you can call their 1-866 number, 1-866-311-1119, and they will tell you, they can schedule an appointment for you to come in, and they will tell you what to bring with you. Can you bring a list of your medications? Can you bring a list of your doctors? Can you bring information on what you're paying now? So you can compare what your plan looks like now compared to what may be available in the marketplace. So they can help someone navigate all the information online and all the different plan benefits and make sure it matches up to what their needs might be.
And Lisa,
very confusing.
It is very confusing. And speaking of that, though, but Lisa, Barbara mentioned that people are confused. They don't always know what things like out-of-pocket, co-pays, deductibles mean. And so as long as we're here, can you remind us about those fundamental parts of health insurance, what they are, and how people can better understand them?
Sure. I mean, your premium is what you're going to pay every month to have your health insurance. Your deductible is what you are going to, what a plan may require you to spend before they'll start kicking in money. These plans also typically have out-of-pocket maximums. So once you go over to your deductible, or once you hit your deductible, the plan might start to pay some of the money, but you'll still have to pay a portion until you've paid X amount of dollars out-of-pocket, at which point usually a plan will pick up everything. And on the exchange, they're generally categorized by gold, silver, and bronze. The higher the metal level, the higher the monthly costs, but the lower the out-of-pocket cost when you actually do get care. So like gold plan, you'd pay a lot monthly, but when you actually get care, you'd pay less. A bronze plan, you would pay less monthly, but when you got care, you would have to pay more out-of-pocket.
And Dan and Barbara, if you have any tips, you can chime in here. Dan, to you first and then to Barbara.
Well, the main tip I have is if this is, I mean, is kind of a plug, like if this all sounds confusing to you, you are not alone. And our one of our recent episodes is about like why we're all likely to choose the wrong health plan because it is really, really hard. I mainly am offering comfort. don't feel bad.
Comfort goes a long way as far as people feeling that they can reach out for help, though. To be very frank with you, if they're like, oh, okay, I'm not alone, I'm not stupid, I am just confused, and other people are too, I think that helps people feel comfortable in reaching out. So that's very important. But Barbara, did you have any tips to share with our listeners today?
If there's one thing you take from this conversation, please don't look at just the premium and what you pay monthly. Please make sure you look at what the deductible might be, like how much do you have to pay out of pocket before any of your health insurance coverage kicks in. I think a lot of people, especially young people, pick that cheapest premium and they're not looking at what the deductible is and what the doctors are in network and what their own healthcare needs might be and how it matches up.
So I want to thank all of you guys for your time today. Thanks to Dan Weissman, Barbara Otto, and Lisa Schechner. We'll tweet out links to their work as well as information that they've shared on how you can sign up for insurance on the online marketplace or any of the resources that they said that you could reach out to for help in making sure that you can get the health insurance that you need. I will ask you to stay tuned to the 21st. We have lots to come, including the history of the University of Illinois, how it came to be in Champaign-Urbana, and why that story isn't well known. I'm Liz Westfield. Stay tuned to the 21st.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting a booth at the Urbana Holiday Market in the Square December 8th and December 15th, featuring regional and special interest titles for every book lover on your list. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The University of Illinois system is a fixture here in our state with colleges in Springfield, Chicago, and of course, Champaign-Urbana. And every year, it gets hundreds of millions of dollars in public money, and about 375,000 U of I alum currently live across the state. And since 1867, the flagship school has been here in Champaign-Urbana. But that wasn't always a guarantee. And back then, a man named Clark Robinson Griggs was a major force in making sure that the U of I ended up here and not, say, in Jacksonville or Lincoln or Normal. So why don't we hear more about Clark Robinson Griggs? To help answer that question, I'm joined in studio by Tom Kasich. Tom has written about Griggs' impact for the News Gazette. Tom, welcome to the 21st, and I want to thank you for being here.
Great to be here.
And Nathan Tai is also in studio with us. He's a doctoral candidate in the Department of History at the University of Illinois. He's also taught courses on the history of the U of I. Nathan, welcome back to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
So, Nathan, if we could start with you, give us a sense of what's going on at this time in history in the mid-1860s here in Illinois.
Well, it's quite an exciting time. Obviously, Abraham Lincoln is in the White House, and the Civil War is well underway. So things are obviously tense, but there is an eye to the future. And so the Morrill Act has passed in 1862 by Abraham Lincoln, which creates the land-grant system. And so at this point, states are now vying for this federal support to expand their educational offerings, and specifically in mechanical arts, so engineering, kind of practical, scientific things, and then agriculture. And so the state of Illinois begins having a conversation about what do we want to use these federal resources for, where do we want to put this new institution, this land-grant institution. But the conversation doesn't really manifest itself until later in the 1860s. There's a long debate in the state of where the institution's going to be. There's already a number of established predominantly religious colleges, little liberal arts colleges that still dot the state today that are trying to vie for this money, that they can use this funding to expand their footprint. They can expand their offerings. So Knox College, Illinois College, Northwestern, Wheaton, Lombard College are all kind of vying for this federal funding and do band together. But there's also a call for a new institution, an entirely new university. And Illinois is relatively late at getting this going. The states around us kind of already have state universities. University of Iowa is older, for example. And so it takes a while for them to figure out what they're going to do with the money, which...
So outside of them kind of being late to the party, so to speak, are there anything or are there any events or things going on that made it an opportune time to do that?
Well, there's a lot of railroad construction that's happening in the area. There's a lot of expansion. And there's debates across the state about the development of state institutions. Different parts of the state are vying for different projects, for example. So Southern Illinois at this time wants a new penitentiary. That this will bring jobs, that this will bring resources, that there's a debate about building a new state house. And it's between Springfield and Peoria. And as we all know, Peoria is not the capital of Illinois.
Right.
And so Springfield wins that project. There's also the city of Chicago would like some state funding for the development of parks and city streets. And so there's a debate about the state about where these different things are going to go. And in here in eastern Illinois, they feel like they need a project like this and have been not been given the same opportunities as the rest of the state. And so they're kind of vying for this university. But railroad development is actually critical to this. And this is the Griggs story is very much tied into railroad development in the state.
So now that we kind of get a sense of what was going on, what the atmosphere and environment was like at that time, Tom, if you could get into who Clark Robinson Griggs was, how did he come into the picture? How did he become a player in all of this?
Well, Griggs was pretty well connected. He had been a state legislator in Massachusetts before the Civil War, came here after the war, became quickly became mayor of Urbana and then was elected a state representative in 1866, I believe, and then right away took off trying to lead Champaign County's effort to get the Illinois Industrial University here. And he was pretty successful pretty quickly.
Well, and Nathan, could you speak to why he came here, or why he thought, like, what was his case? What did he make as far as?
Well, he had been an industrious man in Massachusetts. He ran a shoemaking factory very briefly, and he actually came out to Champaign County to farm, and he owned a farm near Philo, but lost part of his hand in a farming accident in 1859, and so settled back here in town, and then became a railroad developer for the Bloomington-Peoria Railroad, and so was trying to bring this railroad construction. There's a debate that's happening in the communities because the railroad through Urbana goes east-west, and then the north-south line is built in West Urbana, now Champaign. And so there's some concern about which town is going to succeed, which line is going to be most productive, which is connecting to the bigger metropolitan cities. And so he's part of this development and sees the university as something that will bring people to the community, right? That there's going to be increased rail travel, that different goods are going to be having to come to the community, and just will be a boon to the heart of his business, which is railroad construction.
Well, and Tom, could you speak to the tactics that he used in getting the university here?
Well, he was quite the operator, but this was going on all over the state. As Nathan says, I mean, like, Decatur wanted the state capital moved there, and they offered $1 million. So what Griggs did here was he at one point had the invited the entire legislature over on a railroad, on a train, on a Saturday afternoon. And according to the story in the Chicago Tribune, they were served champagne, which made the 5-hour trip a little easier.
You used the word scoundrel in your reporting of him. That was a known word used to describe
there
him?
It wasn't unusual. As Nathan said, this stuff was going on all over the state. And, the state was developing. After the war, we were free to spend money and undertake projects. And so Griggs set up a hospitality house down the street from the state house at the Leland House Hotel, where every night he would offer dinners and theater tickets and, drinks to all the legislators, and essentially bought them off and, became their friend. And this is a freshman legislator.
So is a lot of smoozing and schmoozing going on.
Yeah.
So, Nathan, why do you think Clark Robinson Griggs and his role in bringing the U of I to Champaign-Urbana is downplayed in its current day retelling?
Well, as Tom points out, it's a very Illinois story. The kind of greasing the wheels.
Let's get into that. What do you mean by the it's a very Illinois story?
This is how I think that very many people in the state kind of assume politics works. That we just have unfortunately a long history of graft and grift, and that this is politics as usual. And so this story, the cigars, the theater tickets, the oyster bars, right, that they had this, which they ended up paying, and Tom, correct me, it's $40,000 that the cities bring together, which is about $700,000 today, right, that they are spending for the entire legislative session to buy all these goods and things and buy off the ledges. It's a story that we can all relate to. It's a story that is passé, and it's also in other kind of stories of corruption in the state, it seems very passé, right? Like, oh, oysters and cigars and theater tickets are going to get the university. That's actually nice.
So do you think, or do you know, if there was a movement to say not name halls after him? So I'm an alum myself. Mm-hmm. I've spent many, many years in this community. I've never once heard of like Griggs Hall, Griggs Avenue, Griggs anything, right? So was there a conscious effort to erase that?
Well, when this is going on, actually, there's another kind of crucial figure in the development of the university of Jonathan Baldwin Turner, who actually brings him before the house about what's going on and tries to have some sort of investigation. And they do, and they don't find that anything he's doing is wrong. But I think Baldwin or Turner is indicative of the way that the founding of the university is commemorated, because he remained in the community, and his daughter was a member of the Board of Trustees, and so there's a building named after him. A quote of his is on Davenport Hall, the agriculture building. He was a commencement speaker, whereas Griggs left in 1871 and moved back to New York, and so he didn't have the same multi-generational legacy building that other figures might have had. But there also is, because of the kind of uncouth nature, that's not something you want to necessarily highlight. So no one's there defending his honor in the community after he's left, or trying to tell this story because they got the university. We need to move forward.
Well, and Tom, I see you kind of shaking your head along with Nathan here. So in your reporting, did you find that to be true, or are there other accounts?
You know, it's too bad because the guy deserves some sort of monument in Champaign County, at least by the local government. He has a very short street not far from here, Griggs Street in Urbana, and that's it.
Oh, I stand corrected. Okay. It's,
but you would not notice it. It's only like three blocks long. You know, he had a, after his railroad was built through town, there was a Griggs House Hotel named for him. But, you know, the railroad later became the Big Four, a pretty good substantial railroad. But there's no monument at all to Clark Griggs except that little street. And he deserves more.
Which I think is very telling. And I want to wrap up today's conversation with asking both of you, and Tom, I'll go to you first and then we'll end on Nathan. How do you think Champaign-Urbana would have been different if the U of I had not been based here? How would it have developed as a town without
Dan McCollum, the former mayor of Champaign, always said that, you know, if it hadn't been for the U of I, Champaign-Urbana would be Tolono. You know, just be another grain elevator along the railroad with, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people.
How about you, Nathan?
I echo that completely. I don't think the town would have really made all that much of itself. I mean, this is the industrial powerhouse for the region. I mean, it wouldn't have just affected these two communities, but the entire swath of East Central Illinois.
Well, I want to thank both of you guys for this very fascinating talk on the unknown, often unspoken about history of the University of Illinois being here in Champaign-Urbana and how that wasn't always a guarantee. So thanks so much to Tom Kasich and Nathan Tai for joining us on the 21st today. Finally, before we go, we wanted to follow up on a conversation we had last Thursday about the Day Without Art Project and World AIDS Day. The Krannert Art Museum screened 6 short films that focused on the lives of people living with HIV. During that conversation, we talked a little bit about the current state of HIV, and Adnan Kalra was one of the filmmakers. He was originally from Illinois and works with the Positive Women's Network. He left us this voicemail following up.
I just wanted to call and say thank you again for having Barb Cardell and me on the show last Thursday to talk about the film we made for Visual Aids, Day Without Art. I really appreciated your thoughtful questions, and I wanted to address, though, a couple of things that one of the other guests had said during the interview. One of them was when you asked why communities of color experience a disproportionate impact in the HIV epidemic, the other panelist had said that there's a large amount of ignorance and that young black men in particular engage in risky behavior because they feel invincible. And this, you know, this was certainly not the first time I've heard these kind of arguments, but I wanted to address them both because they're inaccurate and because they further stigmatize marginalized communities. Really, when you look at it, the best available public health research shows that risky behavior is actually equal across racial groups. And yet we still see this racial disparity in HIV prevention, treatment, and quality of life. Communities of color experience disproportionate impact of HIV for the same reasons that we experience disparities along every other health and quality of life metric out there. It's that there are structural barriers that make people of color both more likely to come into contact with HIV and less likely to have access to quality care for prevention and treatment.
And thanks again to Adnan for leaving us that message. You can find that show and all of our past shows on our website, 21stshow.org. You can also leave us your own voicemail anytime at 217-300-2121. That is all the time we have for today. Do you have the NPR One app? You can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. You can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple to download. Set up your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter, search 21ST Show. We live tweet throughout the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And on our Facebook page, search The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments of things you might want us to ask on the air. All of those links and every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, you can just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We are produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Ellen Montecilio. Vishesh Anan is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.